All right. We're going to do our reading from 1984 now. We are in still in part one, chapter five. When we left off last night, Parsons and Sim and Winston Smith, these are three guys that all work together in the Ministry of Truth, having lunch together. And the telescreen comes on with a bunch of statistics about how wonderfully Oceania is doing. So let's pick it up there. The announcement from the Ministry of Plenty ended on another trumpet call and gave way to tinny music. Parsons, stirred to vague enthusiasm by the bombardment of figures, took his pipe out of his mouth. "The Ministry of Plenty certainly done a good job this year," he said with a knowing shake of his head. "By the way, Smith, old boy, I suppose you haven't gotten any razor blades you can let me have?"
"Not one," said Winston. "I've been using the same blade for 6 weeks myself."
"Ah, well, just thought I'd ask you, old boy. Sorry."
The quacking voice from the next table, temporarily silenced during the ministry's announcement, had started up again as loud as ever. For some reason, Winston suddenly found himself thinking of Mrs. Parsons with her wispy hair and the dust in the creases of her face. Within 2 years, those children of hers would be denouncing her to the thought police. Mrs. Parsons would be vaporized. Sim would be vaporized. Winston would be vaporized. O'Brien would be vaporized. Parsons, on the other hand, would never be vaporized. The eyeless creature with the quacking voice would never be vaporized. The little beetle-like men who scuttle so nimbly through the labyrinthine corridors of ministries, they too would never be vaporized. And the girl with dark hair, the girl from the fiction department, she would never be vaporized either. It seemed to him that he knew instinctively who would survive and who would perish. Though just what it was that made for survival, it was not easy to say. At this moment, he was dragged out of his reverie with a violent jerk. The girl at the next table had turned partly round and was looking at him. It was the girl with dark hair. She was looking at him in a sidelong way, but with curious intensity. The instant she caught his eye, she looked away again. The sweat started out on Winston's backbone. A horrible pang of terror went through him. It was gone almost at once, but it left a sort of nagging uneasiness behind. Why was she watching him? Why did she keep following him about? Unfortunately, he could not remember whether she had already been at the table when he arrived or had come there afterwards. But yesterday, at any rate, during the 2 minutes' hate, she had sat immediately behind him when there was no apparent need to do so. Quite likely, her real object had been to listen to him and make sure whether he was shouting loudly enough. His earlier thought returned to him. Probably she was not actually a member of the thought police, but then it was precisely the amateur spy who was the greatest danger of all. He did not know how long she had been looking at him, but perhaps for as much as 5 minutes, and it was possible that his features had not been perfectly under control. It was terribly dangerous to let your thoughts wander when you were in any public place or within range of a telescreen. The smallest thing could give you away. A nervous tick, an unconscious look of anxiety, a habit of muttering to yourself, anything that carried with it the suggestion of abnormality, of having something to hide. In any case, to wear an improper expression on your face, to look incredulous when a victory was announced, for example, was itself a punishable offense. There was even a word for it in newspeak. Face crime, it was called. The girl had turned her back on him again. Perhaps, after all, she was not really following him about. Perhaps it was coincidence that she had sat so close to him 2 days running. His cigarette had gone out, and he laid it carefully on the edge of the table. He would finish smoking it after work if he could keep the tobacco in it. Quite likely, the person at the next table was a spy of the thought police, and quite likely he would be in the cellars of the Ministry of Love within 3 days, but a cigarette end must not be wasted. Sim had folded up his strip of paper and stowed it away in his pocket. Parsons had begun talking again. "Did I ever tell you, old boy," he said, chuckling around the stem of his pipe, "about the time when those two nippers of mine set fire to the old market woman's skirt because they saw her wrapping up sausages in a poster of Big Brother? Sneaked up behind her and set fire to her with a box of matches. Burned her quite badly, I believe, little beggars, eh? But keen as mustard. That's a first-rate training they give him in the spies nowadays. Better than my day, even. What do you think's the latest thing they've seared them out with? Ear trumpets for listening through keyholes. My little girl brought one home the other night, tried it out on her sitting room door, and reckoned as she could hear twice as much as with her ear to the hole. Of course, it's only a toy, mind you. Still gives them the right idea, eh?" At this moment, the telescreen let out a piercing whistle. It was the signal to return to work. All three men sprang to their feet to join the struggle around the lifts, and the remaining tobacco fell out of Winston's cigarette. Chapter 6. Winston was writing in his diary. It was 3 years ago. It was on a dark evening in a narrow side street near one of the big railway stations. She was standing near a doorway in the wall under a street lamp that hardly gave any light. She had a young face, painted very thick. It was really the paint that appealed to me, the whiteness of it, like a mask, and the bright red lips. Party women never paint their faces. There was nobody else in the street and no telescreens. She said, $2. For the moment, it was too difficult to go on. He shut his eyes and pressed his fingers against them, trying to squeeze out the vision that kept recurring. He had an almost overwhelming temptation to shout a string of filthy words at the top of his voice, or to bang his head against the wall, to kick over the table and hurl the inkpot through the window, to do any violent or noisy or painful thing that might black out the memory that was tormenting him. Your worst enemy, he reflected, was your own nervous system. At any moment, the tension inside you is liable to translate itself into some visible symptom. He thought of a man whom he had passed in the street a few weeks back, a quite ordinary-looking man, a party member, aged 35 to 40, tallish and thin, carrying a briefcase. They were a few meters apart when the left side of the man's face was suddenly contorted by a sort of spasm. It happened again just as they were passing one another. It was only a twitch, a quiver, rapid as the clicking of a camera shutter, but obviously habitual. He remembered thinking at the time, "That poor devil's done for." And what was frightening was that the action was quite possibly unconscious. The most deadly danger of all was talking in your sleep. There was no way of guarding against that, so far as he could see. He drew his breath and went on writing. I went with her through the doorway and across the backyard into a basement kitchen. There was a bed against the wall and a lamp on the table turned down very low. His teeth were set on edge. He would have liked to spit. Simultaneously with the woman in the basement kitchen, he thought of Catherine, his wife. Winston was married, had been married at any rate. Probably he still was married. So far as he knew, his wife was not dead. He seemed to breathe again the warm, stuffy odor of the basement kitchen, an odor compounded of bugs and dirty clothes and villainous, cheap scent, but nevertheless alluring because no woman of the party ever used scent or could be imagined as doing so. Only the proles used scent. In his mind, the smell of it was inextricably mixed up with fornication. When he had gone with that woman, it had been his first lapse in 2 years or thereabouts. Consorting with prostitutes was forbidden, of course, but it was one of those rules that you could occasionally nerve yourself to break. It was dangerous, but it was not a life and death matter. To be caught with a prostitute might mean 5 years in a forced labor camp, not more if you had committed no other offense, and it was easy enough provided that you could avoid being caught in the act. The poorer quarters swarmed with women who were ready to sell themselves. Some could even be purchased for a bottle of gin, which the proles were not supposed to drink. Tacitly, the party even was inclined to encourage prostitution as an outlet for instincts which could not be altogether suppressed. Mere debauchery did not matter very much, so long as it was furtive and joyless and only involved the women of a submerged but despised class. The unforgivable crime was promiscuity between party members. But, though this was one of the crimes that the accused in the great purges invariably confessed to, but it was difficult to imagine any such thing actually happening. The aim of the party was not merely to prevent men and women from forming loyalties, which it might not be able to control. Its real undeclared purpose was to remove all pleasure from the sexual act. Not love so much as eroticism was the enemy, inside marriage as well as outside it. All marriages between party members had to be approved by a committee appointed for the purpose, and though the principle was never clearly stated, permission was always refused if the couple concerned gave the impression of being physically attracted to one another.
Hey!